The following is a conversation. It has the features of any conversation, such as imperfectly expressed thoughts, ill-considered opinions, and the notions of several sleep-deprived brains. Try not to get your stethoscope in a twist about it.
What's on tap for your spring break, Fallon? Cabo? Daytona
I'm
Beach?
Going to Hawaii.
What?
Yes.
Look at you. Look how excited she is, too.
We're finishing up all 50 states this year, so we're headed to Alaska in, June.
Wow.
She's so wholesome.
But Alaska in June, Hawaii in...
In
spring break.
March, yeah.
1 week.
Yeah.
Anybody else have spring break plans?
I'm on clerkships.
I know you didn't. I feel like AJ might be in a permanent state of spring break during his M4 year, but
I've been just telling all my friends I'm unemployed.
Nice.
You matched during spring break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what a time.
Yeah. That's super exciting. Congratulations. It's gonna be great.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, the show that gives you an inside look at medical school from the students drinking from that fire hose. It's a production of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. With me today in the SCP studio, if he were a vampire, he'd get full consent before sucking your blood. It's M2 Jeff Goddard.
I like that. Thank you.
She cloned herself and then pushed her clone off a cliff, after which she was charged with making an obscene clone fall. It's M1 Fallon Jung.
Wow.
Get it?
No, I don't.
An obscene clone fall? Think about it. He's an obscene phone call? Yeah, it's not a very good joke. Okay. He's fully HIPAA compliant, but doesn't know exactly what that means, so he won't be speaking much. It's M4 AJ Chowdhury.
I don't know if that's HIPAA compliant.
But if you think that's all shortcuts, you're so very, very wrong. Shame on you. Our guest today is Brian Carmody, pediatric nephrologist, otherwise known as the Sheriff of Sodium. Dr. Carmody, welcome to the Shortcoat.
Thanks for having me.
I think we're big admirers. We're all big admirers here. We have been for years. You're sort of our go-to, especially during and after match week, when you closely analyze the results of the match and other things. I mean, just a great resource. And you have a ton of incredibly thorough and well-thought-out content on your website and YouTube. So listeners, definitely go there and spend some time, even if it is double speed. And... so we're big fans. No system is without its flaws, and so there's always a thread to pull on in medical education. But I wanted to start off with asking, what's your overall assessment of how well the system of medical education does its job?
I guess that depends on your vantage point, you know?
From your vantage point.
Well...
as a physician, as a...
You know, it's a functional system. I mean, we train doctors. The doctors that we train are, you know, they're for the most part, I think they're good doctors. Could things be done less expensively? Could they be done more efficiently? Could they be done in a fairer way? I mean, I think the answer to all those things is yes. But I think, you know, I mean, it's a functional system.
So you're hinting at one of the biggest problems that we always talk about from our vantage point, which is the extreme sort of expense of how things are done in medicine and medical education.
I guess so. I'll be the first one to bite this bullet. I have a problem with medical students complaining about the cost, but I'm a non-trad. This is my second career. So I worked in business before this. I had a couple of small businesses and I ran the finance side of things. If we look at medical school from an investment, saying people complaining that they have to pay $200,000 for essentially, not guaranteed, but almost guaranteed salary of $200,000 plus once they hit attending for the rest of their lives, that's a phenomenal return on investment. And I don't really have a lot of sympathy for complaining about that, but I know that other people feel like that large debt number is uncomfortable. So I try to be nice about it. I don't know. What are your thoughts on just the expense of medical school as an investment for these students?
It's a market that doesn't function exactly the same as some other markets. I mean, you know, and this is true not just in medical schools, of course, it's true for higher education in general, that, you know, there's not really any constraint on raising tuition. And the simple reason is that, Jeff, you may have had this experience. I don't know. Many medical students have not had the experience of trying to buy something expensive for themselves, you know, a car or a house or something. But I mean, you go and try to buy a house and, the mortgage broker is going to be, they're going to be doing their due diligence. They're going to be, looking into all matters of your finances to be sure that you can pay back this enormous debt that you're taking on. And that's a debt that's collateralized. I mean, if you don't pay it, they can come in and take your house, whatever, take your truck or something, if it's something, an auto. And yet, an 18-year-old can sign their name for, up to the max limit of federal student loans with really no, means testing or justification for that at all, other than there's a school that wants to charge this much.
Yeah.
And so it's true. And I mean, the AMC, I've heard their president, among others, sort of state how what a good investment medical school is. And it's not that I dispute that, but I mean, there's no guarantee it's going to stay that way. And certainly the trends would pretend that it's not. There, for any of the for-profit universities that are charging, thousands and thousands of dollars for degrees that don't have a good market value, the reason they charge that amount of money is not because of some, reasonable basis of thinking that their degrees are worth that. The reason they charge that much money is simply that's what the market will bear, and that's what people can get access to.
Yeah, and I do think that there's an argument, especially for trying to say that you should charge different amounts for different degree programs feels like, it feels ethically dubious. I can understand that for undergraduate institutions, but I think it's fair to say that, universities can kind of charge whatever they want because they kind of have like legal guarantees that no matter what, this student is going to pay this, right? Like that they're going to get their money back. And I think that system is, it's not as free market as it pretends to be, that it's just like whatever the market will bear. Like, no, it's because it's also got the backing of the federal government saying like, no, students are going to pay this. So I get that argument. You know, somebody coming out with a degree in Egyptology, they spent $60,000 at a liberal arts college. Now they don't have a lot of opportunities in the marketplace. I feel like they have been taken advantage of. But somebody that's going from, I just looked up these numbers last night. Somebody that's going from the median American lifetime earnings is $1.7 million. The median physician earning in the United States is north of $9 million over the course of their lifetime. $200,000, even $400,000 seems like a paltry price to pay for that big of a jump. And like you said, maybe that changes. Maybe those numbers shift dramatically over the next several years. But so far, I feel like the numbers are in the favor of making that investment.
Well, no, the only things I'd add, to sort of enrich the discussion, I guess I have sort of three points to make. I mean, one is that when we talk about student debt, I mean, one thing that's important to appreciate, which you guys probably do, but all listeners might not, is that when you look at the amount of indebtedness for medical students, not only is that sort of median or mean indebtedness rising over time, but actually, if you look at it more closely, there's sort of actually a little bit more of a troubling trend insofar as it's more debt concentrated on a smaller number of people. If you go back 10 years, there actually were more students who graduated with debt than there are now. But the mean debt is rising, and that's simply because there's a greater number of students who are graduating with no debt at all, either because they go to one of the medical schools, which, of course, just this week, that was in the news again, that there's going to be a new tuition-free medical school, or they do something to make medical school free, like one of the military programs or something like that, or they simply come from families where their parents just cut a check. But one of those things happens such that you have a larger portion of people who have zero debt, and you have a smaller portion of people who have a larger amount of debt. And so, when you look simply at the mean or the median, when you see these statistics, it obscures that fact, which I think is important to think about in these discussions. And if you look at who the students are who have that debt concentrated upon them, as you would expect, it's disproportionately students from lower means coming into medical school. It's disproportionately people from, less prestigious medical schools. So, it is sort of a regressive system, that these people who take on the most debt probably have the least access to the highest paying fields in medicine. So I think that's sort of point number one. Mm-hmm. The second point that I wanted to emphasize in case, listeners didn't catch it, but, you made an astute point just a moment ago about how, student loan debts are generally not dischargeable in bankruptcy. You get those debts hung on you, man, you're stuck. You know, there was a case, which I've talked about a little bit in the past, where there was an American student. He went to a medical school in Puerto Rico. He could not match. He tried to match for a number of years, was unsuccessful, and ended up working jobs like at a Banana Republic and a Starbucks and so on. And ultimately, he was able to convince a federal bankruptcy judge that he had done all that he could do to repay these debts, and he had his student loans forgiven. And whether that kind of case can set a precedent that might change policies, because, I mean, if schools suddenly have to consider whether, you know, the money that the people are taking out. And then my third point, I think I lost somewhere when I got excited about those other two things, but I'll turn it back over to you guys.
We have that problem all the time.
Yes.
I've got one final thought on the first point, and then I'll take the back seat. I know I talk too much. I've often talked about this idea of like who's paying the most for medical school. And I was talking to a friend about Albert Einstein this week. I don't know if we can call him out by name, but like,
that's fine.
I don't know if we need another NYU, you know, a school that's going free and all of a sudden they shoot to the top of the ranking. Like, we don't need another elite institution that isn't charging kids for medical school, but only taking in the kids that get, you know, the 520s on their MCATs or something now. So that only means that the advantaged kids are now even more advantaged. It's not really helping the disadvantaged applying to medical schools. But then again, I'm trying to think, like, how do we solve this? Do we, looking at our DO brothers and sisters and the medical field, those seems to be the ones that are paying the most when it comes to the price of medical school. And then the lack of access to those higher paying specialties. Disproportionately, I feel like those are also the students that are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, probably because they weren't able to afford the MCAT programs or not to have to work during their undergrad. So they have they have lower scores and they have lower GPAs when they're applying to medical school. So I'm definitely interested in finding a way that we can probably, you know, prop up those that are least advantaged as opposed to the ones that are already advantaged. But it does seem to be a trend that we find the people that already have and we seem to give them more instead of helping the ones on the bottom. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, one simple thing that I've said we should do, which doesn't exactly address the problem that you said, but I think it would make things better, is that medical schools, in my opinion, should be required to report their match outcomes and not be able to sweep those under the rug. Because in reality, you know, many schools, you know, I mean, and one of the arguments you hear against this is, oh, well, you know, everybody does fine, you know. And I mean, there are some unintended consequences that are legitimate and you have to think about. But in reality, I mean, like I said, I mean, you go back to the mortgage example I said before. I mean, when you buy a home, the bank doesn't just let you buy it. You know, you got to get a home inspection. You got to make sure that you're not buying some junk home that's not going to be worth what, you know, what you're paying for it. And in reality, schools ought to, in my opinion, they ought to have to list, you know, we had this many people who did this. We had this many people who were trying to do this and did this other thing. You know, there should be a standardized way of doing that instead of the cherry picking and obfuscation that happens, you know, about 2 weeks from now, you know, on social media when schools are proclaiming their outstanding match outcomes.
And how many go into primary care?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, which is, yeah, of course, a silly statistic.
Out of curiosity, do a match outcomes get reported to like LCME accreditation bodies or?
I don't know. Do you know?
That is true. Yeah, I don't know all the nuts and bolts of that. That is true. But I think what's harder for students to judge is, and what I mean, you know, I've talked about this a little bit before too, but, you know, when you have students who don't match, there's a number of things that schools can do that are not exactly, I don't know, they can make their numbers look better. I mean, you can push people to take prelim, you know, only positions. So yeah. A PGY1 position that leads to no training beyond that, unless, you know, manage to snag it.
Whoa.
And that gets counted as a match. And of course, some people have to do PGY1 prelim only positions as a, you know, segue into some advanced training position and, you know, ophthalmology or PM&R or something that they actually wanted. And so when you're just reporting these PGY1 matches, it doesn't necessarily mean that those people had a bad outcome, but many of them did. Many of them tried to match in, you know, otolaryngology and they didn't match. And so they took a PGY1 general surgery position, for instance. You know, many schools, there's been an increasing trend, especially among MD schools, to not graduate people who don't match. So you find out you don't match, well, you just stay in school for another year. and you do some research or you do some rotations or you do whatever. And that benefits the student in a way, because if you're still part of a school when you apply, it keeps you from being screened out as a, you know, someone who didn't match in the past. Mm. You know, so it does benefit you because many programs use that automated filter. But at the same time, and in all honesty, I mean, that's not an ideal outcome for the student. You know, I mean, you wanted to graduate, you wanted to match. In matter of fact, you didn't match. And so being removed from the statistics, because schools will say, oh, well, we had a 99% match rate for our graduating students. Well, how many people didn't graduate because they didn't match, you know, and they chose to hang around longer? That's one way you can sort of sanitize your books. So in my opinion, the entity that's in the position to do this, I don't think schools will configure this in the way that makes them look the best. Mm. And that will circumvent the whole benefit of this, which is, you know, and the reason I bring this up is because you were saying before, I mean, schools really have little incentive to compete with each other on price. And there's little incentive to do that. You know, I mean, most, you know, the median number of medical schools that an MD matriculant got into is one.
Yeah.
You know, you have one school that you got into. That's the average student. I mean, many people get into lots, but you know, the average student, the median number of medical school acceptances is one, you know, for MD, US MD schools. Mm. So if you want people to be able to compete on price, I mean, you have to give them some information beyond just, well, I don't know, US News and Report rankings. Right. So the entity that should do this, in my opinion, is the NRMP, because the NRMP is in possession of the data, number one. You know, you can't reclassify students. It's like, yeah, you tried to match and you didn't, and you're part of this school, so you get counted with this school. Moreover, the NRMP is in possession of the data that shows what you were trying to match into. You know, I mean, if you matched into an internal medicine position, it could be that was just your heart's desire to be an internist, and that's fine. Or it could be that you desperately wanted to be a dermatologist, and you didn't match. And so you matched into a backup specialty. And that may not be that's not necessarily a bad outcome. I mean, in a way, that's a good outcome. But the NRMP is in possession of the data that can tell you that, because you ranked a specialty into which you did not match. And although you matched, you did not match into your chosen specialty. And I don't think that there's, and it is true, like I say, I mean, there's unintended consequences to consider, but ultimately, reporting to people in a fair and standardized way what actually happened, I think that's valuable information. And it's you know, it's useful for USMD schools, it's useful for USDO schools, but my God, it's really useful for the Caribbean medical schools, you know, and offshore medical schools, which many of them are not at all forthcoming about the real stakes of going to a place like that, where certainly some students succeed and they have a good outcome. But, you know, I disproportionately hear from the people who get screwed, you know, who go there and they get screwed.
Yeah. And I guess that's a good time to segue to the question of IMGs and offshore schools. I mean, our system depends a lot on international medical graduates and also these schools, because there just aren't enough USMDs to fill all the positions. Isn't that correct?
That's the state right now. Yeah. I mean, that we have way more medical residency positions that there are US MD and DO graduates. Yeah. But yeah, I do think that the policy, I mean, I think the number of US MDO and DO schools are continuing to increase at the same time that we're seeing many states take measures to create an alternative licensing and training system for international medical graduates. So I do think that we're sort of at an inflection point where things are changing in the future as far as that goes. Yeah.
Shortcoats, if this episode is worth listening to this far, it's worth sharing. So blast us on your socials. And if you want a sticker for your trouble, send us a screenshot. Thanks.
I'm going to ask a question out of complete ignorance, because I just don't understand the system very well. As a lowly M2 over here, if there are more residency positions than we have students, then the only reason why students aren't matching is because they don't want to soap into a specialty that they're not interested in. Is that a fair assessment, or is that, and not to say that would be a bad decision, right? Like, if I just genuinely hate emergency medicine, soaping into it's just not going to do it for me. But is that a fair assessment?
In general, I think that's true. If you look at the number of USMD students and where they're trying to match, like when the charting outcomes reports come out, many USMD students who don't match are trying to match in highly competitive specialties. And that's what they want. And they don't want something else. And that's, I mean, I don't hold that against them in the least. If you want to be an orthopedic surgeon, then, you know, being a pediatric nephrologist is really sort of a poor substitute from that, you know? Yeah. So the reality of those sort of residency match marketplace is that in every segment of the market, there's more people who want that thing than there is of that thing.
Yeah.
So whether you're talking about sort of Ivy League dermatology programs, you know, there's this many people who want it and there's this many spots. If you're talking about community family medicine programs that mainly attract IMGs, there's still this many IMGs that want it and there's this many positions.
Yeah.
So at every segment, there's more people who want that thing than there is of that thing. But overall, if you look at just American, you know, US MD and DO graduates and residency positions, yeah, there's more than enough residency positions for everyone to have one. But they're not the ones that those people want.
Yeah. So the reason why I ask is because I'm really into advocacy, but I really hate advocating from a point of interest for something that we don't need. Right. So like, I don't have any examples that wouldn't be inflammatory, but this is a good example. So next
you never
week,
do.
Dave is very kind with the editing after these episodes. I'm going to DC next week with the AMA to advocate for policy. One of the things that often gets brought up is making sure that we have enough residency spots. I kind of feel like right now, maybe I'm advocating for the wrong thing. If right. there are technically enough residency spots for all US medical graduates, then the problem isn't right. that we have enough residency spots. It's that we haven't incentivized certain specialties to entice students to apply to them.
If they're
choosing to say, I would rather hold out another year for ortho because my life will be so much better in ortho than, say, peds or family medicine, then the problem isn't whether or not we have enough seats. The problem is that certain seats just have gum on them or something.
The distribution is not quite what it should be, I think.
Yeah. Which is an issue worth solving, but I want to make sure I'm focused on the right issue.
Yeah, there's also some artificial inflation going on with residency spots in that there's like hundreds of surgical prelim spots that go unfilled. Correct me if I'm wrong or if my information is outdated, because no one wants to do a surgical prelim unless they absolutely have to. Like, I'm applying IR and I had to apply to surgical prelims. Did I want to rank them? Absolutely not. But those spots are going unfilled while there's going to be a massive shortage of radiologists in the next couple of years. It's already started. There's not seats being allocated to radiology programs simply because there's not enough infrastructure for it. And you see that everywhere. It's not simply that people don't want to go into these spots that there's a lot of open residency spots for. There's also just you literally do not have enough infrastructure for where we do need that expansion. And that's something that I think we're failing to address.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I could say there. I mean, I guess to get back to Jeff's point, I mean, I think, you know, most calls for we need more residency positions are really sort of based out of self-interest. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I mean, like I say, there's many people who want a residency position. They're generally not US MD and DO graduates, but many, for instance, US citizen international medical graduates who go to school in the Caribbean or overseas. Many of those folks really struggle to match. And so often they have the loudest voices saying we need more residency positions. And it's easy to understand how they feel that way, you know? But I'm always a little bit skeptical of those arguments because, you know, when you think about the value that residents add to a hospital, you know, the labor that they provide and, you know, and all the side benefits, I mean, for recruiting and, you know, and so on. Why wouldn't a hospital want to have residents? I mean, plus you even get access to governmental subsidies, you know, for doing this. So on the face of it, it doesn't necessarily seem like something that people would need to advocate for. I mean, if you're sitting on a hospital, I mean, do you need someone from the AMA marching in Washington and waving a sign for you to be like, my God, if I just hired more residents, we could make more money in this health system and that'd be a good thing. You know, let's do it. I mean, you don't need them to say that. I think it really kind of gets to AJ's point that, you know, many of the residency positions that people want to have added, you don't have people or places to train them in the way that we've trained people. You know, I mean, could you add more residency positions at smaller places or at more, you know, where you have a little bit more marginal experience or don't have quite the caseload? Yes, I'm sure we could. Could you add more residency positions at, you know, the sort of the smallest, you know, surgical subspecialties and stuff? You could, but they've been sort of reluctant to expand, you know? So they're not chomping at the bit to have, you know, more and more people come and expand, you know, beyond what they've been expanding already.
So,
I don't necessarily think that's a good goal for advocacy without a better argument for it. And the argument that I think would be a good argument, if you believe the argument, is that there's a looming physician shortage. So, you know, if you say, oh, we need this many radiologists and the pipeline, you know, tells us we're going to have this many, so we need more residency positions. If you believe those arguments, then I think that's a credible argument for expanding residency positions. But the more that I've gotten into this and thought about it and looked at it, the more skeptical I've become at most of most, you know, physician shortage arguments.
I guess for me, so full disclosure, I'm not on a military scholarship to medical school or anything, but I'm somewhat partial, the more I think about it, to the system of allocation that they provide for residency. Like, you can apply to any specialty you want, but we'll tell you which ones we actually need. You know, I'm also here at Iowa. We've been fortunate to have some international students that'll come do some rotations, and I've provided housing to some of them, and I've looked at some of the other modules where you'll have to do like 2 years as a GP before you're allowed to apply to residency or something like that.
Gosh, that seems to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, all of this is to say that what I'm really trying to get at is that I feel like we need to find a way to make primary care, if not an obligation, at least much more of an option for people that are graduating medical school. We need more people in primary care, but I get that, you know, dermatology just looks nicer. I also want my skin to look pretty. I get it. But,
and the simple answer there is just there's not as much money in it as like orthopedics or derm or radiology. Primary care, you're working way harder for way less money usually. Like cranking out 15-minute patient visits for 25 patients every day, 5 days a week, just will burn you out way faster than like reading a couple of studies, doing a couple of cases in radiology and making like $600-700K a year right now is what the job offers are going for. Man. Like there's just no way around that. This is like
Fallon
you said,
is reconsidering
this
her whole
is a
plan.
Big investment.
Not.
So like we need money in primary care. We need to get more actual physician salaries that are attractive to people investing all this time and money into their education and then going into the field.
I would think though that if you have more people going into primary care in the first place, you'd have less work that needs to be done by a singular person. That'd be my thought, at least. I don't really know. I mean, I'm sure that we would find more work to give people, but
that's yeah, right. I'm not sure that's true. Yeah, yeah. That's I think one of the points that I try to point out to people is that, yeah, I mean, I haven't talked about this a whole lot, in part because it's always been on my to-do list, you know, to talk about more, but I don't because it gets people so mad.
You know, we like mad around here.
There's not a physician shortage. But I would put it to you. I mean, I'd put it to all you guys here and see what you think. Most of the things, I mean, if you push and you say, so tell me why you think that there's a physician shortage in such and such. And I mean, you can think of different answers you might get. Or actually, I mean, what would you say? I mean, what tells you that we have a physician shortage? What data point or finding or observation? I mean, what is it you see that tells us that we have a physician shortage?
Wait times.
Wait times is a good data point. Any others?
I think there's a... There is a sort of a signal of what's to come in thinking that, you know, Americans are getting older.
So, I mean, if in terms of wait times, I'll tell you a little story. So, you know, I'm a pediatric nephrologist. My physician group went down a physician. It's a smaller group, but we had somebody who left and went elsewhere. And so, you know, children continued to stubbornly persist in having just as much kidney disease as they did in the past. So, you know, we all had a little bit extra work.
Pretty selfish of them, but okay.
So before, when our group was fully staffed, if your child needed to be seen, we could see you within a matter of days. You know, our wait times were very short. And then gradually, as we've gotten more, you know, backed up, you know, now we're booking out, I don't know, about 3 months or so now for a new patient visit. And certainly there's some groups that are, you know, worse than that. But I'll tell you, I noticed something real funny as my schedule got booked out more and more in the future. I started having a lot fewer no-shows and same-day reschedules. And it makes perfect sense why. I mean, if you are a parent and you schedule your kid's appointment and it gets to be that day and you're like, oh, gosh, I forgot I had this happening today, or my child's school's having a party, I don't want to pull them out of school for this or whatever it is. You just call the office, and if you can get an appointment within the next week or whatever time suits you, why would you not do that? You know, of course you would, right? But if you call and they're like, yeah, all right, well, then come back. We'll see you in June. They're like, no. All right, we're making this happen. You know, the easier it is to schedule, the more people will schedule, you know, and they'll schedule as it suits them. And in a way, that's a good thing. But from a practice standpoint of running a practice, as you know, there's a certain amount of overhead. I mean, the lights cost what they cost. The space costs what it costs. The staff, they cost what they cost, regardless of whether they're just sitting around all day or whether they're busy. And so really, it's the last few patients you see each day that make your margin, you know, that make your salary. And so you have an incentive, and certainly primary care physicians, you know, have this incentive. Or actually, I mean, if you want further evidence, I mean, go to my dentist. You want to go to my dentist? Man, they're going to burn your phone up like the week before your appointment, like with text messages, reminders. Like, by God, you know, they're not wanting to have 10 minutes sitting empty, you know, because that's their margin, you know? And so one thing that I would say about these wait times is, in a way, I mean, I really believe this to be the case. If you just simply train more physicians and you have them practice in a system in which the incentives are the same, in which they have just the same incentives to fill their schedule up, then physicians will make more work for themselves. Instead of seeing that follow-up appointment in 4 months, you say, come back in 3 months. Instead of 2 months, you say, why don't you come back next month? You know, physicians will, you know, procedural specialists will do more marginal procedures. There are things that are not really ideal for the system, you know, that are a function of the incentives that exist. And unless you change those incentives, I think you'll just have more people who still have the same incentives to do the same thing. So that's one thing. And then the second point, you said wait times, and what was the other?
Number of older Americans.
Yeah. Let me think about that for a minute too. So here's another problem with all this modeling about, you know, physician shortages. Most of it is sort of analytically just very, very simple. You know, what it does is, you know, it says we have this number of doctors and we have this number of patients. And in the future, we're going to have this number of patients in these different age groups. So, you know, all doctors are going to keep doing the same thing. So we need this many doctors to serve this many patients.
Sounds simple.
That's the analysis that gets done. And of course, there's a lot of things that assumes. It assumes that, you know, that doctors will keep practicing the way that they are now, you know, which with more nurse practitioners and physician assistants and so on, I think that's not a good assumption. You know, those schools are churning people out every day. And the tail of, you know, when you train a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant, I mean, you've got a tail of a 30-year career ahead of you. You know, it's not like you can untrain them if you decide, oh, yeah, actually, we don't need so many of these folks, you know, once they're trained. You know, but then there's other assumptions too. You know, you assume that medical care is going to be occurring the same way it is as it is now. And it's just really hard to predict that. And you can think of all the ways that, I mean, just in my career, for instance, I mean, when I was a pediatric resident, we always had a lot of patients with cystic fibrosis in the hospital. I mean, that was sort of a core. I mean, any given day, you could walk up and find kids with CF in the hospital. Almost, I mean, I very infrequently see those kids now because the therapies are better. You know, they stay outpatient more. You know, and that's just sort of one simple example. But I mean, better examples are if you think about things like, you think about cancer care, you know, as cancer care gets better, are we going to need more doctors to deploy chemotherapy once it becomes more targeted and less toxic? I don't know. You know, are we? I'm not sure. You know, if you went back in time, I mean, you can think about it. If you went back to, just as a thought experiment, suppose you went back to like, I don't know, 1960s when they're devising like, you know, the first surgeons are doing coronary artery bypass and graft. And it was saving people's lives, you know, with coronary artery disease. And if you'd asked the surgeons then, like, and said, hey, you know, we've got this, you know, this baby boom generation that's young now, but I mean, in the future, they're going to be old. How many cardiothoracic surgeons are we going to need? I'm sure they would have said like tons. I mean, like, we're just starting to do this. Yeah. We're just getting the tip of the iceberg. But what they didn't envision, of course, was that a lot fewer people would be smoking. You know, in 30 years, you're going to have less cardiovascular disease. And moreover, a lot of the cardiovascular disease, someone else is going to be managing it. You know, the interventional cardiologist steps in and all of a sudden starts doing most of those cases. And those are things that you wouldn't have been able to model or anticipate, you know, at that time. You know, there's a paper that came out earlier this year in New England Journal for a new medicine that inhibits the renin-angiotensin system that you would infuse once a year. I mean, how many doctors are we going to need if you just go and get your infusion once a year to manage your hypertension? you know, and that kind of stuff is very hard to predict. So I'm skeptical of all these models because they're superficial and we can't know. And I mean, we can't know what way things are going to break, but I think we can be confident that people aren't going to be practicing the way that they are now. I mean, especially if you're looking at more than a few years in the future.
Well, you made it to the second break. You tolerate us. If you can, consider donating or buying a sticker or something. Visit theshortcoat.com and help us do stuff without having to beg a dean for money. Thanks.
So let's look at an example that's happening right now. This may or may not be something that you can speak to, but so we live in Iowa, and depending on the year and the model that you look at, we're somewhere between the 48th and the 51st out of the entire United States for OBs per capita. And the United States, this is something else I did this week. I looked at the World Economic Forum and all of these like data trends, and every country in the world has a decreasing child mortality rate, which is phenomenal, and I love to see that. The United States is one of five countries in the world that has an increasing maternal mortality rate. And here I am sitting in Iowa, which has the fewest OBs per capita, thinking, how in the world are we addressing the fact that our moms are dying at a higher, like double the rate that they did in the year 2000? Is it that we need more doctors? Is that the problem? I don't know, but certainly having 50, like being 50th in OBs per capita, it probably isn't helping. I don't know. So yeah. Those are the kind of data points that I look at, and I recognize that those aren't necessarily like very causal. I can't say like if I just had more doctors, this wouldn't be a problem at all. But
yeah,
certain things I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, on the face of it, you're right. I don't have a lot of expert knowledge on that topic, but I mean, on the face of it, I would say I don't think that it's lack of doctors that's contributing to maternal mortality. I mean, I don't think that's probably it. I mean, if you look at those tragic cases where people, where mothers or newborns are dying, I mean, it's social determinants of health. I mean, it's that they're not seeing doctors. And so training my doctors is not going to help. It's that their nutrition is not good. It's that they have, all the things that go into that, they have many adverse social determinants of health. And that's not something that you can fix by medical schools graduating more people. That's a harder fix.
I just didn't know if maybe plopping more OBs, and again, Iowa's a fairly rural state. I don't know if plopping more OBs out in the rural communities, or at least family medicine that can practice OB, is something that would help get access to that prenatal care that's so vital to
healthy outcomes. Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, certainly, yeah. I mean, like people trying to deliver babies outside of big centers, you're right. I think that probably is a big contributor. But I guess if you step back and you think about it again, why is it those places don't have OBs right now? I mean, is it because there are not enough OBs, or is it because those positions are not attractive to people who are trained in obstetrics, and they'll continue to be unattractive? Because if you go to a place where, again, if we're working in a fee-for-service system, and you go to a place where there's X number of deliveries a year, and it supports an obstetrician, but it doesn't support a group of obstetricians, who wants to go there and be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? I mean, nobody's going to want to do that. Nobody's going to take that job,
Yeah.
But yet, if you put a group of four people there, they're going to starve to death, in a fee-for-service model. So again, I think unless you address the incentives that led the system to be the way that it is now, simply training more people won't fix the problem.
I've been chomping at the bits to ask about the whole IMG and USMLE scandal that's been going on.
I mean, I felt like it's just, for the last month, it's been like this swirling discussion on the internet. And I know you've covered it to some extent, Dr. Carmody. I wanted to get your, so maybe AJ, you've been paying attention. Maybe you can sort of summarize this topic for us briefly so that Fallon can go, can do class. Sure.
Well, also, I've actually not heard of this yet.
Okay, go.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Essentially, there's been an anomalously high scoring country on the USMLE step one and two in particular that's been discovered in the last couple of months, which, by the way, this is a trend that it's not necessarily just one country now that this has been going on. This is something that goes on everywhere that USMLE is proctored and administered. So this isn't necessarily to simply call out one country, but they just happen to be so good at it that their success has gotten the better of them. They've been caught like 280, 270s regularly from this country. So essentially, the USMLE has caught this one country, this one testing center in one location.
Are you avoiding saying the country?
Wait, what is a regular score? What is the best score you can get?
If you're in the US, the median step two score is like in the 240s or 250s.
Yeah, okay. High 240s.
And what is the highest score you can get?
Like a 300.
Okay.
Which is like usually 260 plus is already, you're gunning for like dermatology at Harvard. So there's not really much purpose beyond that. Okay. So this country, I'll just say it's Nepal. It's very public. There's litigation ongoing right now about it. There was one testing center where a lot of people were taking the test at the end of a test administration cycle where like certain number of testing forms are given in a certain period with similar or with sets of answers that are different from each other, but they're given throughout this period and then they're replaced. And so a lot of people were going to this testing center at the end of these cycles where these forms are recycled. And then they're taking it and they're scoring really high and leaving the testing center early. And this led to the discovery of like this major cheating network in Nepal of people finding test questions that essentially were being memorized so that test takers in that testing center in Nepal were scoring much higher than usual on those questions. And the reason why they were caught and also why there's strong evidence to show that this was cheating is because they weren't scoring that well on questions that weren't shown before. Like if there's a new experimental question, people were scoring like they would usually or lower on those compared to like a test taker in the US who didn't cheat or anyone anywhere that didn't cheat. And this just in Nepal is now being investigated in other countries like India, Pakistan, Jordan, so on and so forth.
Yeah, so I guess one of the questions I have, Dr. Carmody, is what's the point of this step two system at this point?
I just feel like if you're putting that much like effort into cheating, like if you just put that much effort into actually studying, like you just, okay.
Well, yeah, so there's much we could talk about with this. And I feel like I've said probably a lot of it. Yeah, if you see my last few YouTube videos, because I mean, I was interested to hear you say, Fallon, that you hadn't heard about this, because I have received more DMs, emails, correspondence of all kinds about this issue than I have about anything that I've ever talked about. I mean, I've probably gotten more stuff about this than I have like after step one went past fail and they canceled step two CS combined. Like, and those were my previous like sort of high water marks as far as like getting a surge of people, you know, asking me what I thought or asking me about this or that or the other thing. So, but it's, you know, at this point, this is something that's, you know, isolated to overseas medical schools. So yeah, it's interesting that many residency programs, I mean, program directors are unaware. I mean, unless they are ones that recruit international medical graduates, but among international medical graduates, it's a big issue. You know, it's a big discussion. So yeah, it's, I guess to answer your question, Dave, I mean, it is true that the USMLE is a licensing exam. It's an exam that's administered to assist licensing authorities in making a yes or no decision. And from that standpoint, a score is not necessary. But early on, the NBME made a decision that examinees benefited by reporting the score, that they had a right to know how high or low they were, you know, doing, and that there were benefits to reporting that to the examinee. And then, of course, you know, because of the accessibility and applicability of that metric in a world where we have overall more residency applicants, you know, of all types than residency positions, then, you know, that score has been used as, you know, the single most important metric to decide whether to give someone an interview or not. So, you know, and certainly for international medical graduates, I mean, it's a form of currency. You know, I mean, the USMLE step one or step two, you know, nowadays score, I mean, it's true. It's like money. It's a construct that we use to exchange for something of value, you know, which is residency interviews and residency positions in a country where medical practice is more appealing than in the country, you know, where you went to medical school.
So I guess my initial thought on this is, if this is something that's probably been going on for a while, if they have this like advanced of a network going on, and most residency directors weren't noticing any sizable or noticeable difference between the quality of these applicants or these now interns, I guess, or these residents how useful is this score for telling us whether or not these are quality resident applicants, you know? More to your point, I guess, is once you pass a certain benchmark of medical knowledge, how, you know, is a 290 really telling you that this guy is going to blow it out of the park as a resident, or is he just going to be as good as the next guy at doing the actual job?
Until March 15th, this score is extremely useful, and my score is the most useful of all of them.
Fair enough.
I agree with your point, Jeff, that I don't think I think there's little evidence to say that, you know, USMLE scores, whether we're talking about old step one scores or step two, function in a linear way. That someone that's a 265 is definitely better than a 255 or a 245. You know, I tend to agree that there's probably, in general, there's a threshold effect beyond which, you know, gains are increasingly less important and are probably more likely to be outweighed by other things about the applicant. You know, your work ethic, your personality, your, ability to interact with patients and so on. You know, I mean, I do think that's true. But when you're a program director that's looking at a giant pile of applications and you want something easy to thin down that pile to a number that you can actually review in some detail, then USMLE is by far the easiest metric to do that.
I think whenever you give somebody data, a number, they're going to use it. And they're probably going to use it in a way that isn't necessarily valid.
For me, it feels like drawing that cutoff score, whatever it's going to be, if it's 240 or 230 or 250 or whatever, is about as arbitrary as just cutting the stack in half or something like that and just looking at half of them. But
yeah, I remember a time when the score that we would be really proud to mention, we don't do this anymore, but the score that we would be really proud to mention in your medical student performance evaluation, your dean's letter would be 230. And the average score is just far surpassed that at this point. We don't mention the scores anymore.
Yeah, I'm not expecting to get a 270. So
no, come on.
With that being said, the questioning of whether test scores, well, step one is already pass fail. Dr. Carmody, you alluded to this a couple of times in the past. Do you see step two also becoming pass-fail in the future? And if so, why? And what alternative metrics do you think program directors would use to differentiate applicants at that point?
Yeah, I do think that it's going to go pass-fail. I think that, I mean, to be honest, I think it's inevitable, really, for the same reasons that step one went pass-fail, which is that, you know, the metric chasing, you know, when students have to do more and more and more to achieve, you know, tiny marginal gains that don't seem to outweigh those costs, more and more people, meaning people at USMD schools who disproportionately have a voice in shaping these policies, are going to demand that it be made pass fail. I think that will occur. I think when that occurs, I think that there will continue to be pushes for other objective numeric measures of quality. And I hope that program directors will articulate what they really want. And so far, I've been kind of disappointed they haven't. That's sort of one of my frequent things when I get the opportunity to speak to program directors, which, yeah, actually this morning I was thinking about a talk that I got coming up in May. And it's one of the very points that I want to make is, you know, applicants will do whatever programs want them to do. Mm-hmm. You know, schools will do whatever programs say they want applicants to do. And too often, I think program directors are too content to outsource that decision-making responsibility to the NBME and just say, well, I need an objective measure. You know, everything's, you know, I mean, sort of the old man, you know, yelling at the cloud kind of persona, instead of saying, you know, I want schools to meaningfully evaluate this competency. I want a measure that tells me about someone's such and such. And instead of doing that, it's easy to just sort of complain and then outsource it to, you know, something that exists for a different reason.
I guess my worry is that I'm totally fine letting this quote unquote objective measure go by the wayside because, as we're saying, like, it's not really that objective to show the quality of the applicant. But at some point, program directors and applicants alike are going to have to admit that most metrics that we're using, if not all metrics that we're using, are subjective, and that there is a level of luck or arbitrariness to this that, like, I don't know. I think we like to pretend in higher education that it's a meritocracy, but I think at some point somebody has to admit that's just not the case. Like, it's like there are so many factors that go into the luck of this application process that if we just admitted that, I think we'd all sleep a little bit better at night. We'd probably have fewer, you know, stress or whatever, you know. But I don't
I'm
know.
Not sure AJ would sleep better.
Well, I think what you said is true. I mean, most things are subjective, and that, but I got to say, you know, just because something's subjective doesn't mean that it doesn't necessarily mean that it's valueless or, you know, fair, not meaningful. I mean, you know, we live in a world where, I mean, for sake of example, people define beauty differently. I mean, would we be better off as a world if there was one scale for beauty and, you know, you were wherever you were and people aspired to get the maximum thing on that scale or whatever, would we be better off with that? Or are we better off with people sort of having slightly different and often overlapping definitions of beauty so that, you know, you think your partner is the most beautiful person in the world, or you think, you know, I mean, are we better that way? I think we probably are. And I think that in reality, I think residency selection would be better if we have more ways for applicants to demonstrate merit. And so they can take their God-given talents and run with it as far as they can in whatever area they're best prepared to demonstrate that merit and have that merit be recognized, instead of forcing everyone, regardless of what their skill set is, to, you know, for instance, excel on multiple choice questions, you know?
Well, I think that we need to wind this up. Probably Dr. Carmody has things to get back to in his life. But thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's a real honor to have you talking with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. You know, I have opinions on most things, so I'm always happy to chat and kick around ideas and think about them.
Fantastic. Shortcoats, go follow Dr. Carmody as the Sheriff of Sodium on YouTube. Subscribe to his blog at thesheriffofsodium.com. I do. Anything else you want to plug?
No, not really.
Okay. Fallon, Jeff, AJ, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
And what kind of cheat would it be if I didn't thank you, Shortcoats, for making us part of your week? If you're new here and you like what you heard today, follow the show wherever fine podcasts are available. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. This show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and ongoing support from the Writing and Humanities program. Our music is by Dr. Vox and Catmosphere. I'm Dave Antler saying don't let the bastards get you down. Talk to you in 1 week. Hi, Shortcoats. Look, life in medical education, life in America, life in the world is often difficult. And I often wish I could help. All I have is this podcast, but in my wildest dreams, you have the support you need to lead a life of your choosing. You deserve to be happy, healthy, and successful in whatever ways you define those words. So if you need support because you've experienced racism, discrimination, harassment, mental health crises, I want you to be able to get the help that you need. And so I'm going to put some links in the show notes to some resources that you can use. But the bottom line is that, for what it's worth, I see you. I know you're out there. I wish I could do more. Maybe I can in ways that I don't understand yet or know about. But I see you, and I'm glad you're here, and other people are too.
The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.